8, 69. Light and variable winds at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Wednesday night, clear with a low of 42. Currently, it's right at about 60 degrees here on the campus of UL Lafayette. Coming up at 4 o'clock, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. We're going to begin this hour by heading into the studio with Judith Merriweather.
Joining me in the KRVS studios this afternoon is Mariusz Smoly, conductor and artistic director of the Acadiana Symphony Orchestra, here to talk about a lovely concert that you all have coming up this weekend, Friday and Sunday, at the Cathedral of St. John in Lafayette. And I know you all have been trying different venues, you know, of course, the full orchestral experience at the Hyman Center, but you all have been doing some smaller chamber music programs at the Acadiana Center for the Arts, and this one at St. John's. Why did you choose that venue?
I think every type of music has its perfect home, perfect hall. And there are certain works that will sound really well in large spaces. There are some that require more intimate acoustic and settings. And there's certain type of music that is suited to be performed in churches with the church-like traditional acoustics such as St. John. That's why we are playing this weekend, and the music that has been chosen and the type of programming, I think, is very well suited for those acoustical circumstances.
Well, it's certainly aesthetically a lovely space in the cathedral.
Right.
Describe the acoustics. What do you think of them? How would you describe them?
Well, it's very rich. You get a lot of reverb after each note. Therefore, one needs to be very careful which type of texture, in addition to the style and programming, is appropriate, which is not. Obviously, you can play things that are on the slower side, where the musical narration is somewhat slower. And when you go to the faster tempos, you have to be careful not to play them too fast and make sure that articulation is very precise, very crisp. And well, when we prepare our programs, even when we rehearse in other spaces prior to going to the concert space, we really start working on those elements from the first minute of the rehearsal, because you need to adjust your sound and your production to kind of this acoustical vehicle you're going to be riding in during the performance.
Yeah, I think so many of us are not as keenly aware of the sound landscape around us as you would be, just talking about reverb in a space, or thinking that you could change the tempo of the music to suit the venue that you're in.
Absolutely. You need to make those adjustments all the time. And all the performers who perform in different halls, they are very keenly aware of what to do, what not to do. We have our friendly halls, not so friendly halls. And then within a hall, we call, well, this is a cello-friendly hall, because some spaces tend to amplify certain colors or ranges of instruments. I know in cathedral, for example, the low register is quite well emphasized by the structure.
So you could play the Bach cello sonatas really well in there.
Right.
Yes.
And then when you work with the orchestral sound, you need to take into consideration and perhaps not encourage the cellos to play too much, because you can overbalance the entire sound of the orchestra by having too much of the bass line prominent. It's both art and science.
Yes, I could see you doing a whole program on that, you know, inviting students and listening to those different sounds and tempos in the cathedral. If you are just tuning in, my guest is Mariusz Smoly, conductor of the Acadiana Symphony Orchestra, talking about their upcoming concerts. There will be two, called Music and Faith, at the Cathedral of St. John this Friday and Saturday. Well, what music did you choose for this very particular special concert in this venue?
The repertoire that is perfect for music under this title is so vast, because the church historically was and still is one of the largest sponsors of music. In the early centuries, through the activities of the church, we really developed the Western system of notation, Western system of polyphony. And, you know, 90% of the development of so-called classical music happened because of church activities, the musical forms, the musical sound, the musical instruments, the actual compositions, the commissions, etc., etc. So this is a wonderful wide gamut of repertoire that is one or the other way connected with the church, or connected with spirituality. It doesn't have to be a purely religious element to make a music spiritual, right? We can have those emotions and those associations on many different levels. So the music that we'll perform this weekend comes from many different musical styles in many different centuries. Of course, music of the Baroque era will be featured very prominently because that was probably the highest point in the development of church music. We will have compositions by Johann Sebastian Bach, of course, who is the church musician of all times. Mm-hmm. Excerpts from his St. Matthew Passion and excerpts from one of his cantatas. We try to also make this program appropriate for the Lent season. So that connection is also very important for us because of the venue, and I think it's appropriate. We're going to hear parts of Mozart Mass in C minor, which is, of course, the classical period. Also from the classical period, we'll play movements from two Haydn symphonies. You know, Haydn wrote 104 symphonies. And they're not really programmatic works, but they have a lot of titles, and the spirit of the music really carries certain message, certain emotion, which the title also represents. So we have movement from so-called Lamentazione symphony, symphony of laments, lamentation, and three movements of La Passione symphony, symphony for the time of passion. I think a very interesting take on how you can write programmatic music without really having a narration and a very close storyline along with the music. And there is a one contemporary piece on the program. I'm very especially excited about this piece. It's by Polish composer Henryk Mikołaj Górecki. It's a movement from his famous symphony number 3. Górecki, throughout his entire life and the output, was a very spiritual composer. He wrote a lot of works either connected with the faith or strictly for church purposes. He happens to be a headmaster of my high school, to which I went, and then he was the dean of the School of Music where I studied, and I went to school with his daughter, so I know the entire family and him quite well. So I always naturally was a big admirer of his talent and extremely excited when suddenly, from just being one of the most important Polish composers, he becomes this international star due to a recording of the Symphony No. 3 by David Cinnamon and Baltimore Symphony that hit the top of the Billboard charts and stayed there for several months. And still, till today, this is the best-selling classical recording in its category of symphonies ever, and the most successful in terms of ranking all those Billboard charts.
Well, I have clear memories of when we first started playing that piece, and I know many of our listeners probably remember where they were when they heard that piece for the
really?
First time. I know I do.
It's a very special composition, and it puts you into a different world, different place. We were rehearsing it yesterday with the orchestra, and I told them, you know, this is one of those pieces where the time stops, and you're just in special stillness. And it's such a rare experience, especially nowadays. And it's very difficult to get into that mood as a performer, and perhaps not so easy as a listener. But once you get there, it's a very special place and a very special time. And you can make this relationship, such a relationship with a piece of music that allows you to slow down, allows you to enjoy this moment of time. And Górecki's music has this power to do it, to help us do it. The second movement is a very dramatic, tragic music. It is with soprano solo. And each of those three movements of the Symphony No. 3 has a little story behind it. The title of the entire symphony is a symphony of sorrowful songs. The second movement is especially sorrowful and especially telling. It has two chunks of text. The first few lines are taken from a wall of the prison in Krakow, Gestapo prison. Gestapo was the German secret police that was one of the occupying forces of Poland during World War II. And an 18-year-old girl who happened to be in that cell before she was taken to and be executed because she was a member of the underground, she wrote a few lines on the wall, basically a farewell message to her mother. So Górecki uses those two lines of that text. This line survived after the Krakow was freed from German occupation. People went to that prison and it was recorded. And I think it still is there as part of the museum. A very powerful message. And this, the second part of the lyrics of the text that the singer is singing is a Hail Mary in Polish, because it's the whole movement seems to be dedicated to mother, the biological mother and the spiritual mother. That's how he interprets, how the composer interprets the connection. It's very moving, very beautiful, and I think this, going back to the location of the concert, the St. John Cathedral is a perfect place to present it, because those beautiful long chords, sustained chords, will sound just right, just perfect in the cathedral. And so that's my favorite part of the program.
yes, I'm very moved just hearing you talk about that. If you are tuning in, we're talking about the Acadiana Symphony Orchestra's upcoming concert at the Cathedral of St. John this Friday and Sunday. My guest, Mariusz Smoli, is talking about the repertoire that they'll be playing, including that piece from Gorecki Symphony, again, that so many of us know so well, who've listened to KRVS for many, many years. Mm-hmm. And he was your headmaster.
Yes.
That, how lovely. Did you ever take music with him, or did he teach music there at all?
He did teach composition. I didn't take any composition classes with him, but after I became member of the Penderecki String Quartet, which did a lot of contemporary music, of course he was very much interested in my career and career of my colleagues. He was very supportive, and when I had my very first job in the United States as a professional conductor, as assistant conductor with the New Jersey Symphony, he has a family in New Jersey, and he quite often used to visit his family in New Jersey when he was going on some international tours. Towards the end of his life, he conducted some of his works, and he was constantly invited to universities in the United States and all over the world to lecture, to give demonstrations, and received a number of honorary doctoral degrees from various universities. So New Jersey was one of his special places to visit or to when he was in transit. So I had a number of lovely meetings with him after I already graduated and became a member of a well-known quartet. And then the New Jersey Symphony was preparing performance of Symphony No. 3. I wish I was asked to conduct, but at the time the music director did it. And Gorecki came to the performance and I spent time with him talking about the piece. And so I feel quite close to him and to his spirit. And he died last year. So it's very special for me to be able to bring at least a little part of his wonderful compositional output to Louisiana.
Well, it will be very special for us. I'm sure that all of that will inform your conducting and the way the orchestra plays. Mm-hmm. Again, as you mentioned, people who have not heard this piece, what a lovely opportunity for them to experience it in the cathedral. Mm-hmm. Again, one of the best-selling albums of that genre ever.
Ever. Yes.
So yes, take that opportunity this Friday or Sunday at the Cathedral of St. John. Tickets are available at the door.
At the door, better please call our office. They are not being sold through Ticketmaster, but through our office and our website. You can buy them either by stopping by at the office or going to the website at www.acadianasymphony.org.
And we haven't spoken about your guest artist because we've been talking a lot about vocal music, obviously, in the cathedral. Who will be joining the orchestra?
Jennifer Welch Babich is a wonderful American soprano. She sang at the Metropolitan Opera and many wonderful opera companies all over the world. She's teaching at the University of Utah right now and still concertizing all over the world. I think she's the perfect soprano for Gorecki and for, of course, the other compositions. She is definitely soprano with the wonderful coloratura, but she has this warmth and depth into her sound which is very much needed for Gorecki. That's why I thought she would be a good person to help us perform this piece.
Well, for those people just tuning in, can you quickly run through the program again?
Yes, we'll have a program titled Music and Faith, music that has a lot of to do with spirituality, religion, coming from many different historical periods, starting with Baroque, will be music by Johann Sebastian Bach, parts of St. Matthew Passion and his cantata, also some music by Vivaldi. Then from the classical period, part of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart's big mass in C minor, and parts of two Haydn symphonies that relate to spirituality and religion, Symphony No. 26 and 49. And from the more contemporary repertoire, one movement from the well-known, famous symphony number 3 by Polish composer Henryk Mikołaj Górecki.
And again, my guest, Mariusz Smoli, conductor and artistic director of the Acadiana Symphony Orchestra. He'll be conducting the orchestra in the Cathedral of St. John this Friday, and that will be early, actually 7:30.
7:30.
And then on Sunday you have an early concert.
At 3 p.m.
3 p.m. So you have your choice, or you can go both times
both
if you like. Just an amazing opportunity to experience that venue and this repertoire of music, and particularly the Górecki piece as well. And so much the more wonderful now that we know the connection and how special he is to you. Mm-hmm. For more information, you can go to the website.
Go to our website. Mm-hmm. Again, www.acadianasymphony.org. And for the tickets, you can call 337-232-4277.
Well, thank you so much, Mariusz, for all of your work and the beauty that you bring us. And thanks for stopping by.
Thank you very much.
And thank you both. Judith will be back in just a few minutes. And I guess we'd be remiss not to, right now, play that second movement of Górecki's Symphony No. 3, Opus 36, Symphony of Sorrowful Songs. Performing, soprano Christine Brewer, with the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra, Donald Runicles conducting. one of the pieces that will be performed by the Acadian Symphony Orchestra at St. John's Cathedral this weekend, the second movement of Gorecki's Symphony No. 3, Opus 36, the Symphony of Sorrowful Songs. Soprano Christine Brewer performed with the Atlanta Symphony, Donald Runicles conducting. It's 26 minutes past the hour of 3 o'clock. This is Public Radio for Acadiana KRVS, Lafayette Lake Charles.
Thank you.
Joining me in the KRVS studios this afternoon is Emmy Morgan with Creative Action, and we hope to be joined by Colin Miller in a little while. You all have been very busy this year working on a competition called Imagine Downtown, Lafayette Open Ideas Competition, that you all came up with sometime last year to really encourage creativity and thoughtfulness about where we live. So just kind of walk us through the project and how you envisioned it.
All right. Yes. And thank you for having me today. We appreciate this. This was actually an idea that one of our board members, Panat Zanaman, who is an urban planner, came up with. I think he said, came up to us in maybe in July or August and said, you know, guys, this is a really big project that I have in mind. But I think it could be really great. I think we should have an urban design competition, an ideas competition about the future of downtown Lafayette, and get everyone's ideas out there. So what we did was we said, "Oh, that's a great idea, Panat, and we're going to help you do that." And it's going to be a lot of work for us, but we're really excited about how it's come about. We've had about 100 applicants and then about 50 entries into the competition, I believe, that were from all over the world with some really exciting and energetic new ideas for what downtown can look like and in six sites in downtown. And what we did was we broke downtown Lafayette up into six sites. And for each of those sites, we have a winner. And each of those winners is going to be awarded a $1,500 cash prize at our exhibition opening, which is going to be on April 13th at the Acadiana Center for the Arts. We're going to have an exhibition featuring the six winners and maybe images and parts of projects from other submissions that we've gotten. It should be a really exciting event.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that some people who are listening right now, and we've been talking a lot about the Lafayette Comprehensive Plan, the Creative Action Project, which is in collaboration with a number of other organizations. And it seems like there's a lot of emphasis on planning and envisioning, and seems like it's something new. But, it really isn't. I was looking back through some old articles from the newspaper in Lafayette back at the turn of the last century, like, the 1880s, 1890s. And there was a lot of that going on then as well, this idea of being progressive and making sure that we were the center and open to the future. I mean, they used those same kinds of phrases, and planning for schools and planning for roads and plan. It was all about planning.
Absolutely.
And so it's really interesting. There's really nothing new under the sun in that, there are these moments in our history, the time that we're living, that really seem to call for that. And maybe it's been a while since we felt those same urges to be so conscious of planning.
Right.
But you all are wonderfully offering all of us this opportunity to think about it and to actually see some ideas become concretized.
Right. Well, and I think one of our main objectives as a group and as individuals is we think it's really important for communities to have a self-reflexive dialogue and constantly kind of reevaluate what is it that we want as a community? What are our values? What do we think we should look like in the future? How can we get there? And really have a dialogue among ourselves as community members from all aspects and all parts of the community and really involve lots of different voices in that dialogue. That's why we didn't want to just show our vision for downtown. We wanted to open it up to everyone, and not even just in Lafayette, but all over the world to submit their ideas and say, this is what you could have. This is what these are the things that are working well. This is how we can build on those things, how we can capitalize on them and move forward in the future. And I want to emphasize, too, that these are ideas. They're purely theoretical. They are not going to be built. They're not going to be handed over to a construction firm or have any bids on them or anything like that.
Although we're not opposed to some of them being inspired by these
ideas.
Like
that's right. I can imagine at the opening, people seeing some of these drawings, just falling in love with them and working towards something like
Absolutely.
That. But yes, I mean, we're all taught to envision and wish and dream, and that's how something finally comes about.
Exactly.
And this is just a little more complex dreaming, trying to imagine social structures and urban structures. So
right.
these people, okay, again, all over the world, what did they get? What did they know about Lafayette? How did they begin their imagining?
Well, I'm going to let Colin Miller, he's okay. our chair for creative action, and he's been one of the real leaders on this project, discuss that. I want to put in a real quick word here. Creative Action is the host for this event, but we're partnered with a number of different organizations, including ULI, the Urban Land Institute, Louisiana Chapter, the Acadiana Center for the Arts, AOC, AOC Community Media,
The UL School of Architecture
Absolutely.
And Design.
Can't leave that one out.
Right.
It's a whole bunch of names. And Urban Land Institute is partly how this project came about.
Mm-hmm.
It was through a discussion. I don't know if Emmy mentioned Panat Zanaman, the project coordinator for Imagine Downtown. He's the general coordinator. He sort of came up with the idea through discussions with Eddie Guidry of Urban Land Institute, Louisiana. And Urban Land Institute it's based in – the Louisiana chapter is based in New Orleans. Well, they've been talking about the idea of possibly setting up shop in a second location in Louisiana. And Baton Rouge came up in the conversation, and our friend and board of advisors member and project coordinator, Panat Zanaman, said, well, take a look at Lafayette. I think Lafayette would be a good spot for that. And our friend Eddie with ULI – who he actually studied at UL, and he said, you know, that might actually be a good idea. Let's talk about a collaboration between Creative Action and Urban Land Institute Louisiana. And Panat said, well, let me think about it, and I think it would be a good idea to do some kind of urban design exhibition that we could co-host together. Mm-hmm. And I'll see what Colin and Emmy and everyone else think about it. And we were immediately sold on the idea. Although it's been a big undertaking, but it's definitely been interesting, and it's the first project of its kind in Lafayette. But anyway, sorry, your original question was how did they find out more information about Lafayette?
What did they see? You know, we're looking at some people here from Slovenia. I mean, how did you disseminate information, and what sense did they get of who we are and what kind of a place this is?
The initial, I guess where all of this sort of came from in terms of all the information that other people started receiving outside of this region, it started with the competition brief, which was put together by Panat and Hector Lasala and Sarah Young. And it described the areas. It had a very simple map of each site. And it talked about the festivals here. There was a description of what the comprehensive plan is. That it's getting a lot of community feedback. That there's a lot of talk about planning, as you were saying earlier. And what it talked about Downtown Alive. So a lot of the cultural and things that are going on here. And then it laid out some of the potential issues with downtown. Some of the things that in some ways prevent it from becoming everything that it could be. And this is something that is talked about with the Downtown Strategic Framework Plan, where I attended one of the first meetings for that, and the planners from WRT who were drawing up the comprehensive plan as well as the downtown plan were saying that downtown, for instance, has a lot of urban barriers to foot traffic and things like that. So we were when we set out, we described some of that. We also had our partner, AOC Community Media. Some of their staff drove around in a truck, almost like a Google car, you know, with a camera on the hood. It was a wide angle shot, and they drove around each of the sites. And, you know, it had like the street names and all that stuff. And then when the video was edited, you know, and split up, you know, there's sort of a YouTube video for each site. And that's all on the website. underneath the maps and description of each site. So I think we gave them a pretty good impression of what we would like, of the sort of issues that we would like for them to cover, what are the benefits, or what are some of the existing really great qualities that downtown has.
Mm-hmm. And so then you just sent that out across the world and invited people to submit their suggestions and dreams for those spaces. Now, there were six spaces, and people could choose one or all six if they wanted to.
That's correct, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I was shocked with the amount of excitement that we got back from people. I really was very surprised that we had an entry from Slovenia, that we had, you know, all from every continent. Almost we had submissions. We had China and Africa and South America and Europe, and it was incredible response, which I think shows that we have an interesting place that people think, oh, this is something that they want to look at, they want to think about, and we have something to offer them.
Mm-hmm. And what I'm sure that this question is in people's minds. What is the value that you see in plans for our spaces from people who live so far away? What is the value in that to you? Why would you think that? Because all of these people who won are from other countries, other states. What does that bring to this competition? What does it add to it?
I'm glad you asked that question, actually. one of the things that we first started talking about when we were planning the Creative Economy Summit, which was Creative Action's first event, and it was in 2011, one of the three sort of central issues that we were talking about was cultural diversity, as well as a diversity of ideas and how those things are interrelated. Cultural diversity, for instance, brings people with different, you know, ethnic backgrounds, religious backgrounds, who think differently, and that produces sort of cognitive diversity. So I think, for instance, I have a lot of friends who have moved to other places, and they're happy they did. Not all of them ended up loving the places where they moved, but they're glad they had that experience because they were able to be in a place where people simply thought differently. Mm-hmm. And that was of a huge benefit for them. And it's another reason that in the academic sector, universities, you know, you're encouraged to go out of state and study with people who grew up simply in a different place with different ways of thinking.
Mm-hmm. I like that phrase, cognitive diversity. And your project really does bring that here. And even though we think we know a community so well and we know what's best for it and that really our ideas would work best for us, we don't really know that until we see those different ideas. And perhaps people see things in ways we can't because we have habits, habits of thought.
And this is really meant to spark a conversation. Mm-hmm. This is by no means the end of where we're stopping, right, when we have these six sites and we have the pictures and these final ideas. Well, they're not final ideas in my mind. They are a starting point for the conversation. And it's not us saying, oh, these are the best things for Lafayette. It's us saying, well, these are some ideas.
And what do you
what
think
do
about
you think?
This?
Right. Mm-hmm. And if people don't like it or they disagree with an idea or they think that something could be better, we want to hear that. That's what we want people to begin thinking about, because this is so important to us as a community right now, because we are going through our comprehensive planning process. And that's something that we need everyone's input on. Otherwise, we have that lack of diversity. We have the same few ideas, those same few minds coming together and talking about it over and over again. You need that intermix of ideas and personalities and backgrounds to fully encompass what we have here and to fully express that to its fullest potential. Mm-hmm. And so we want people to get inspired from this, from seeing these images of what other people think Lafayette can be like, and say, well, I have a great idea for Lafayette. I want my voice heard through the comprehensive planning process, through my interactions with my civic government, through my interactions with nonprofits or other community groups. I want to put my voice out there and have a part in my community.
Encouraging involvement and thought about where we live.
Absolutely.
If you are just tuning in, my guests are Emmy Morgan and Colin Miller, who are on the board of Creative Action, the founders of that group, along with some other very creative people. They began this project, Imagine Downtown Lafayette Open Ideas Competition, this past year, and they now have the winners. And I know people will want to know how those were chosen.
Yes.
What sort of a panel did you have?
We had a panel of, I think it was five. It was five judges. Let's see. One of them was Steve Oob, a local, obviously very well-known architect. We also had Sylvia Vargas from WRT, which is the Wallace Robertson Todd that's putting together the comprehensive plan for the city. And then a few others who are escaping me right now. But those are the two names.
There's Justin Garrett Moore, John Knott, and Jonathan Siegel were also on the jury. And I believe that a number of those were either selected through ULI, helped us to find some of the jurors, and also Panant Zaneman had some contacts within the urban planning world that we brought in.
And so what did they choose? Were you all surprised, delighted by the selections?
Well, I will say that looking at some of these plans, you know, I'm someone who is educated in visual art, and I saw some of the renderings and said, "Ooh, pretty pictures." But I probably would not have been the right person to be on the jury simply because I don't have that background in urban design, planning, or architecture. So what I would think, oh, that's pretty, they would say, well, okay, take a closer look at it, Colin. Here's, you know, they
this
didn't take this
work
into consideration. For instance, they leveled this building that we pretty much said we wanted them to keep and so on. I'm like, oh, yeah, okay, yeah, you're right.
So that's why you get that impartial to choose. Well, so they took all these selections and came up with three choices from other countries and then three from cities in the United States.
Which is not a planned thing. That's not what we told them to do. That worked out that they said that these were the six winners, one for each site. And that I think we were also really surprised that there weren't as many people from Louisiana who submitted or who were in that kind of pool. But I think maybe – I don't know if maybe people were intimidated or didn't – that maybe the word was spread more out in the urban planning world and that picked up there.
Well, I think a lot of the people that were interested in submitting locally were students. You know, I know Hector had many of his students considering the project, not necessarily as part of their schoolwork, but that, you know, he had encouraged a lot of his students to enter, and then some of the other students were taking, you know, the sites and doing their own work as part of their academic projects. We didn't end up getting a lot of entries locally. I do know that we were hoping that some more firms and people in the professional sector, not necessarily the academic sector, but some more people in the professional sector and firms would do some entries. But we did understand that, you know, they're all very busy. They have schedules and, you know, they have budgets. And
I would think that people in other countries and other cities would think of this as a rather exotic place. And they would be quite attracted, thinking, oh, La Louisiane, Louisiana, whatever, however they say it, that it would be of great interest to them
Absolutely.
To consider.
And I think there's some really interesting puzzles when you look at planning in downtown Lafayette. Like Colin was saying with the urban, that the urban designers Wallace, Roberts, and Todd have pointed out to us in the comprehensive plan process, we have these pedestrian barriers. Like no one wants to cross Johnson Street on foot. You can. There's crosswalks. I've done it. It's actually a lot easier when you do it a few times and you think, oh, well, this isn't such a big deal. But you look at that street and you think, that doesn't look safe for me to be walking on or riding my bike on. And what's so interesting is that urban designers have all of these strategies and techniques to get us past that point and to make us see that as something that we do want to where we do want to walk and ride our bikes and walk from the university to downtown because it's so close. I never think about the ability to walk from university to downtown, but it's really only what, 5-6 blocks. I mean, that's mm-hmm. nothing. So it's really interesting to see how other people have taken on that challenge, which I think are some really interesting challenges, not only with the physical structures we have, but then the different cultures that we have mm-hmm. and the history we have. I think all of that combines to make something that's very interesting challenges and puzzles for people within those fields.
Mm-hmm. Right, to make our familiar known spaces more possible, give them potential in ways that we just aren't imagining.
And then all of that planning, all of that, you know, where does this sidewalk go? Do we widen the sidewalk? Do we, you know, what do we do with bike paths and all that? All of that planning, you know, has an effect on things like commerce. Mm-hmm. You know, so you know, creative action is, you know, we talk about the arts and benefiting artists and things like that a lot, but that there's a, you know, all the way around these things have. Economic impacts mm-hmm. in the way that people shop, in the way that people go out, in the way that people go and eat, the way that people go and travel right. to work. And
for example, if more students felt comfortable walking between campus and downtown, how would that affect the businesses downtown? Or how would it affect businesses if you had more people from Freetown and surrounding neighborhoods walking through downtown and interacting more between the different communities within downtown.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I live right next to UL, and I can't tell you, and I work downtown. I can't tell you how many times I have woken up in the morning and looked at my bike. My poor lonely bike that
and just haven't ridden it
that
to
it's
work.
Been neglected. Yeah. And I think, oh, maybe I'll ride my bike to work this morning. And I think, oh, God, no. Then I'll have to like cross University or Johnston. And I just don't want to deal with that today. And a lot of people feel that way. And that's what we're talking about when we talk about urban barriers. Mm-hmm. And that's just one of many, many things that is something that can be repaired or bettered through things like urban planning.
So real quick, I want to say I want you to list the winners and for the mm-hmm. sites, Colin. And I want to get a quick plug in here about our exhibition coming up in April at ACA. It's going to be at the April Art Walk. We'll have a really exciting opening. I think it's going to be very visually exciting. And we hope to get people involved with some interactive things at the exhibit. And use that as a platform for people to be able to react and to be able to begin this dialogue and discussion based on the winning submissions that they're looking at in the exhibition.
And then the Urban Land Institute plans to take the exhibition after it comes down in May. So it will be up during Innovate, and we plan to offer walkthroughs with a member of our committee, possibly Panat, possibly myself, whoever is available. But we're talking about offering some walkthroughs during Innovate, which is the 8-day festival that Chamber of Commerce.
Absolutely. We'll look forward to talking more about that as it gets closer.
Yeah.
So who are the winners?
The winners are some of them are teams. Mm-hmm. So I'm just going to name the titles of their projects. But Site 1, which is I think we called it just generally the Main Street site, Sustainable Democracy, Democratic Public Space for Sustainable Downtown Lafayette. Site 2, the winner is New Acadia, Retrofitting Urban Decay. Then 3 is The Nooks. 4 is Celebrate Lafayette. 5 is Eco Housing Lafayette. And 6 is Innovation Factory, Across Cyber Balkanization.
Great titles. I can only imagine what they're going to look like. If you are tuning in, we're talking about Creative Actions competition, Imagine Downtown, the Lafayette Open Ideas Competition. Of course, you had several partners. You mentioned them earlier. You've been working in collaboration with them. Those are your winners from all over the world and the country. They've been selected. And Emmy, you were mentioning the opening that will be the second Saturday Art Walk in April.
Right.
And so hopefully maybe we can have you all back just before then and talk about that opening. Let us know more about it. So people can still go to your website and find out more mm-hmm. about these winners and the program.
That's creativeactionacadiana.org. And we'd love to have – and we also have a Facebook page. We'd love for you to go on and like our Facebook page at Imagine Downtown Lafayette mm-hmm. and also Creative Action's Facebook page as well. And we also want to have your feedback on there.
All right.
Thank you.
We look forward to that continued dialogue as Lafayette progresses into the future. Well, thank you all both. Again, Colin Miller, Emmy Morgan, both on the board of Creative Action and doing some great work in our community. And it's lovely. You know, you all are in this wonderful stage in your lives where you've graduated from college. You haven't created those habits like so many of us have. And you're open and you're making all of us think and consider in different ways. And so we really appreciate that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Mrs. Ballinger is one of the ladies who pursue culture in bands, as though it were dangerous to meet alone.
Ladies Who Lunch, this week on Selected Shorts from PRI, Public Radio International.
Coming up Wednesday at 10 p.m.